Welcome to another episode of the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. And of course, an entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how to make Michigan's political machine work for the people. Now, from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's the award-winning Pat Johnston.
Oh, yeah! Welcome to another entertaining installment of Michigan's premier political podcast. I'm Pat Johnston. I have to say, this is always my most favorite time of the year. I think Michigan is at her best from mid-August through about Halloween. I mean, the late summer and early fall time period in the state is not only the most beautiful, in my opinion, but it's also the most comfortable time of the year. The temperatures get warm enough in the daytime to wear comfy clothes, and then the temps drop at night to the point where you can open up the windows and drift off to dreamland. Ah, yes, it's just one of the many reasons why I love this state. Another reason why I love the state is that we stood our ground in the battle to protect our country's democratic principles. Despite Donald Trump and his dopey gang's attempts to overturn the 2020 election, Michigan held the blue line of resistance. We had leaders who ensured Michigan could withstand the right wing's assault on our democratic institutions. We had people like Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, Attorney General Dana Nessel, Governor Gretchen Whitmer, and so many countless others right there on the front lines to stop what Trump and his followers were trying to do. We pride ourselves on always pressing forward here in Michigan, learning from the past, so we don't make the same mistakes again. But the right wing in the state are fighting for autocracy backed by their crazy views of Christian nationalism. Keith Owens of Detroit Stories Quarterly wrote a column in the Detroit Free Press recently about the rise of Christian nationalism. Owens says that the deity of Christianity might take some offense to the term Christian nationalism, he writes. And who knows, maybe I'm wrong, right? Maybe it's A-OK to conflate a religion that is supposedly based on loving others as yourself and promoting the idea that we are all of us, made in the image of God, with a questionable philosophy that full-on endorses white nationalism, white superiority, and anything else that says the rest of us fall just a few dark shades short of perfection. But I don't think so. Owens is right, and we're seeing how that kind of radicalism is spreading across the state. He notes how the Christian nationalist group, which calls itself Ottawa Impact, took over the Ottawa County Board of Commissioners this year. The radical Ottawa Impact group is trying to instill its vision of white Christian nationalism, which I talked about earlier this summer with Joe Spaulding, who's a progressive activist in Ottawa County. We talked about how one of the first steps that Ottawa Impact took after taking over the commission was eliminating the county's Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Department. The Ottawa Impact Group claimed that the department was divisive. Yes. And here was Joe Spaulding's take on that move right here on the podcast a few months ago.
Just like ending the DEI office, which they did on day one, wasn't meant for anything else other than to be a middle finger at an already marginalized population, by which I am a member of, right? Because yep. Lake Holland especially, but Ottawa County has some of the highest concentration of Latino Americans in the state of Michigan. And the DEI office, it was specifically helpful to the Latinos in the community, but also the growing Asian population. And I made sure this was clear. And I knew Jacob Bonema, one of the two that's been kind of teetering back and forth that did vote in favor of this resolution. I talked to him before he got elected. I made sure that he understood that he was in a place at the time, Holland is 26% Latino. And that when they end the DEI program, which they did on day one, there's no way to perceive that except for spitting in the face of the Latino community.
And you see, that is the whole point of the white Christian nationalist movement. It is to erase the history of those they don't deem really American. And please don't forget how the Ottawa Impact majority changed the county motto there from where you belong to where freedom rings. Because telling all Michiganders that you are welcome to live in their county is frightening and apparently a communist kind of thinking for the Ottawa Impact crowd there. It's this kind of crazy, autocratic, radical Christian nationalism that we're seeing happening around the state and the country as groups named Moms for Liberty are fighting to ban books from public libraries and public school libraries. In a few minutes, Debbie McCullough from the Michigan Libraries Association will join me to talk not only about how these right-wing groups are attacking our library system, a system that's vital to our democracy, but they are attacking the library system in order to erase voices and historical information they don't like. But Debbie's also going to share how we can fight back, thanks to the My Right to Read initiative, and she'll be on shortly to discuss this in more detail. So erasing history is just one of a number of ways that white Christian nationalism is hoping to take control over local governments, the entire state, and the whole country. But if it has to be done violently, then so be it. We have just witnessed Donald Trump be indicted for the fourth time this year. This time, the state of Georgia has charged Trump and 18 co-conspirators with leading a criminal organization to steal the 2020 election in the state and other states, including Michigan. And you know what? I just have to say this. It'll be so much fun to see which of these people, like Rudy Giuliani, Jenna Ellis, former chief of staff Mark Meadows, and all of the others, it'll be so much fun to see which ones flip on Trump. Or, and this may not be out of the realm of possibility, please hear me out on this one, what happens if Trump eventually flips on them and complains that he was only listening to the things that they were telling him? Come on now, I don't know if that's really that much of a crazy thought. Anyway, there are so many Michigan connections to that case and to the federal case brought by Special Prosecutor Jack Smith, which has charged Trump with trying to steal the election with the assistance of all these fake electors and with the help of the 16 fake Republican electors who have also been charged here in Michigan. Now, Trump and his followers lost, but they were never going to accept that they lost. So they tried to steal it after all legal avenues were exhausted. And when they couldn't steal it through intimidation and fraud, they turned to violence. Enter the January 6th insurrection. A few weeks ago, after the Jack Smith indictment of Trump, I talked about those 16 fake Michigan Republican electors who now face significant jail time. They include former party chair Michonne Maddock, Michigan Republican National Committee woman Kathy Birding, Kent Vanderwood, who is the mayor of Wyoming, and Stanley Grott, who serves on the Shelby Township Board of Trustees. Grott, by the way, is now facing a recall threat. Now, these people, along with the others that I didn't name, are going to prison. They are going to prison for Donald Trump, for a guy who doesn't care about them, for a guy who would never want to be seen with them in his own home. And many of these people are old, and they may die in prison. How did they become so radicalized? Well, right-wing corporate media, the internet, social media. I mean, I'll always remember one of Rush Limbaugh's final shows before he died. Remember, I used to work in conservative radio, and the station I worked at aired Rush Limbaugh for like 30 years, so I had to hear almost every episode. And I'll always remember when he aired the entire press conference featuring Giuliani, Sidney Powell, and Jenna Ellis when they were spreading lies about hackable voting machines, interference by communist governments, and of course they claimed Antifa played a role. It's the same press conference, if you recall, where Rudy's hair was bleeding. You remember that? And of course, all of the fraud, according to them, happened in more racially and ethnically diverse cities like Detroit, Philadelphia, and Atlanta. Strange how that just always happens in their minds. Limbaugh, in his final days, could have taken the high road and declared that the election was just a loss for the right wing. But no, he went to his grave, continuing to radicalize his listeners by pushing these radical right-wing conspiracies. I mean, it's so sad that one guy had that much control over a significant amount of people throughout the country, and they followed Limbaugh to his grave. And as an aside, I have to make a note of this, Limbaugh would always mock the dangers of smoking and would mock it on the air by telling his audience that he was holding a piece of paper in his nicotine-stained hands. And they loved him for that. They loved that he took it to those science-based, know-it-all liberal nerds. Then he died at just 68 years old of throat cancer, but it didn't mean a thing to his listeners. All sense of logic were sucked away from their brains. They were taught to always be the real victims of society. They were taught that everyone else was wrong and that they were the true patriots. Hence, that's how we got the January 6th riot. And that's how we get stories about Matthew Kroll from Linden, Michigan, who pled guilty for his role in that riot, which was meant to violently thwart the will of the people who voted for Joe Biden to become the next president of the United States. Now, Kroll lost his bid to become a sheriff in Genesee County back in 2016, and he also says that he's the executive officer of the Genesee County Volunteer Militia. Yeah, he tried to become sheriff. Well, he marched towards the Capitol on January 6th, and that's where body cam footage from a Capitol police officer caught Kroll fighting with police. Kroll threw water bottles at police and attacked a line of police officers. And according to the court filing, he grappled with a police officer, stole the officer's baton, and used that baton to strike at least two other officers. Then Kroll waved the baton in the air as if it was an act of celebration. One police officer suffered an injured hand by Kroll. And here's my favorite part. Kroll initially lied to investigators. He said, yeah, the footage might be someone looking like him, but it really wasn't him. What a buffoon. Oh, and he also told investigators that January 6th wasn't a riot, but it was a quote-unquote peaceful protest. You see, lying for these people is part of the game because they believe they are on God's side, the white Christian nationalist side. Matthew Kroll will be sentenced this December after pleading guilty. He could serve 6.5 years in prison. That means he could be around 74 to 75 years old when he gets out. Huh. Was it worth it? All for Donald Trump? Yeah, maybe it was for people like him, because they believe in the entire white Christian nationalist myth or movement, which is, let's be honest, a fascist movement. It's a movement that throws away all rules, procedures, and laws to get what it wants. And when all else fails, it turns to violence. I mentioned how former Michigan GOP chair Michelle Maddock is one of those indicted fake Republican electors. Her husband, Matt Maddock, is Republican state representative from Milford. And by the way, Milford, come on, do better, people, do better. What an embarrassment Matt Maddock is for you. Maddock attended a Free the 16 Electors Poolside Party fundraiser. Oh, that sounds like fun. It was hosted by the Grand New Party Pack that was chaired by Representative Steve Cara of Three Rivers. And by the way, Three Rivers, you too can do much better than that. Well, thanks to a recording from that event posted by The Messenger, Representative Matt Maddock is heard predicting violence if right-wingers keep getting indicted. Via The Messenger, here's that recording. Listen.
If the government continues to weaponize these departments against conservatives and the citizens that are then the taxpayers, you know, what's going to happen to this country? Does anyone have any idea if this doesn't stop? No, what's going to happen? No, what's going to happen before that? Yeah, the goal is communism, right? Or Marxism. The Democrats' dream, right? But what's going to happen before that? Someone's going to get so pissed off they're going to shoot someone. That's what's going to happen. Or we're going to have a civil war or some sort of revolution. That's where this is going. And when that happens, we're going to get squashed. The people here are going to be the first ones to go.
Again, these people are so radicalized, beyond certifiable, that they really believe violence, in the end, may be the only recourse they have. But it always comes back to them, as you just heard Maddox say, that when the violence happens, we're going to get squashed, meaning conservatives. They are always the victims. I've already said a few times how the right wing will go to any length to end up on the winning side so they can spread their autocratic white Christian nationalism. That includes erasing history and erasing people they don't deem on America's side. And those people usually include people of color, non-Christians, LGBTQ+ Americans, and progressives in general. This is why there is a concerted effort by right-wing forces financed by rich right-wing activists to ban books detailing African American history, Native American history, Latino American history, LGBTQ plus viewpoints, books about gender identity, and anything else they fear weakens their white Christian nationalist cause. They are attacking libraries now, and librarians. They're also attacking librarians across the state and all over the country over books they deem unsuitable for children. That's not what this is about. It has nothing to do about the children. They see the writing on the wall. They see that Generation Z is the most progressive voting bloc. Rather than try to win them over and future generations over policy ideas designed to improve their lives and the state, the right wing would rather try to use censorship and book bans because the right wing views those books as indoctrination. And let's be honest, they've had some success across the country and here in the state. Voters in Jamestown Township and Ottawa County, for example, went against the millage for the library, virtually voting to defund the library. And on top of that, due to the threats of violence, librarians across the country are leaving the profession, which is what I believe is really the whole reason for this anti-library, pro-censorship movement. It's to defund libraries and to force librarians to leave their jobs. Please, don't be fooled that this book banning crowd is some grassroots effort. No, as The Guardian covered recently, many of these local groups are backed by big money right-wingers. For example, the most noteworthy group, Moms for Liberty, belongs to a website that is operated by a group known as Parents Defending Children. Now, both of these groups wrote a letter earlier this year to U.S. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona about federal efforts to include teaching about the consequences of slavery and the contributions of Black Americans in U.S. society. They were concerned about that. You see, it's about erasing the history of those they deem not truly American. The Parents Defending Education group is bankrolled by big-time donors like Leonard Leo, who is the former vice president of the Koch-funded Federalist Society, who also used to advise Donald Trump on judicial appointments. That's how we got Neil Gorsuch. That's how we were able to get Amy Coney Barrett and Brett Kavanaugh. So don't be fooled into thinking this is some grassroots movement. It's part of an overall strategy to destroy the very institutions that make America, well, America. Thankfully, progressives are not sitting back and letting this happen. And thankfully, the Michigan Library Association is fighting back against this level of intimidation and censorship. Debbie McCullough from the MLA is standing by to talk about how you can join in this effort to save our public libraries from those trying to destroy all of them. It's a campaign called Right to Read, and Debbie McCullough will talk all about it with me in just a few moments. You're listening to LOL.
It's the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. Need to give Pat a piece of your mind, or do you have some stories you think Pat should cover? Email him at leftoflansing@gmail.com. And if you have Michigan beer ideas for Pat, he'll love you even more. Now, here's Pat.
Let me first take a quick second to thank my good friend Rich for helping out and setting up leftoflansing.com. There, you can get a complete archive of the podcast episodes, my Friday shorts, and other thoughts and complaints I share there. It's always nice to have the freedom to express my thoughts in a way I know that I can best communicate them. So, Rich, thanks again for your assistance on leftoflansing.com. Speaking of freedom of speech and expression, libraries have always been a place where we celebrate such values in our society. Visiting your local library is a place where you can find books, magazines, news, and entertainment whenever you need it. Libraries are places filled with information about the past, present, and future. Libraries help fuel our imaginations by making the impossible seem possible, and libraries are a part of our community that helps us all understand the importance of free speech and expression and how and why those values are such a cornerstone to our democracy. However, over the last couple of years, libraries suddenly became ground zero in the right wing's culture wars as groups in Michigan and across the country are fighting to ban books they deem unfit for their local libraries and public school libraries as well. There is an effort, though, underway here in the state that's designed to push back against these efforts to censor certain books, which is a clear violation of the First Amendment. And joining me to talk more about this effort is Debbie McCullough, who is the executive director of the Michigan Libraries Association. Debbie, thank you so very much for being on the podcast this week.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm excited. You knew so much already. I think you just explained my whole thing.
I doubt that. Well, I'll tell you what. Can we start things off by having you just kind of give a quick overview of the Michigan Libraries Association and what it does on a daily basis?
Sure. We are one of the oldest and largest library associations in the country, and we have been advocating for libraries since 1891, so a little over 130 years. And we have close to about 2,500 library professionals and supporters who are in every community across the state. So we call ourselves champions of access, and we believe that libraries are absolutely the heart and soul of every community and campus throughout Michigan.
In my intro, I talked a little bit about why I believe libraries are important institutions to our society, but could I ask you why you believe that libraries are so vital to each and every community, especially here in the state of Michigan?
You know, I will continue to say that libraries are more than just books, and they are not the same library that I knew as a child. And they are doing so much to connect with community members, whether it's through Wi-Fi access or audiobooks or finding people jobs or getting people to sign up for veteran services. You know, they have maker spaces now, they have gallery spaces. They're community centers, they're for socializing. And I think that our libraries, again, you know, they really create the place in our communities where people have total access to any kind of knowledge and information that they are looking to gain.
Yeah, it's just not like back in, like you said, a while ago, I remember like the card catalogs, right?
Yes. Those low tours. I don't think they exist anymore.
I understand. Everything's digital now, but you brought up a great point. It's a library is a community center. It really is.
Yeah. When we talk about, I'll use the words thriving and dynamic communities, libraries are a part of that. They're a part of our existence. And whether you use a library on a daily basis or you use it a couple of times a month or maybe even once a year, it just depends on what your need is. But those places really create the kind of community that we all want to live, work, visit, and play in. So we have almost 396 library systems. Public library systems throughout the state of Michigan. And there's maybe 650 buildings. So some libraries have more than one building. But in every community, if you looked at a map of Michigan, and we have that up on our website, if you look at that map of Michigan and you put a little dot where every library is, it absolutely covers the entire state of Michigan. So we do recognize that it's about public access, about having a variety of materials that are available to anyone that walks into that library, and they create the kind of thriving community that we all want to be a part of.
Debbie McCullough, Executive Director of the Michigan Libraries Association, is my guest here on this week's episode. Well, during the last few years here, right-wing groups have waged this battle against libraries and public school libraries, too, by demanding that certain books should be banned from libraries altogether. And these fights are even leading to the defunding of some libraries across the nation and also here in Michigan, which we'll touch on here in a bit. But there is this new effort to help provide a counterattack against these groups. And the effort is called My Right to Read Campaign. That's MI, Right to Read. It's an effort spearheaded by the Michigan Libraries Association. So Debbie, I will let you describe more about this campaign, how it all kind of came up and what you're hoping to achieve from it.
So I would say at the end of 2021, when we really saw what was happening around the nation, and we were sure that it was going to cross the borders into Michigan, what we saw was, you know, censorship efforts. And it was the volume of attempted censorship efforts and kind of that extremist rhetoric that we're witnessing across our nation that we wanted to address. It's unprecedented. Libraries in the past, maybe one challenge a year, right? Maybe. Yeah. Some have gone many, many years without having a book challenged. But this year and last year, just increased attempts to remove books from the public libraries and school libraries. So, you know, we're living in tumultuous times. And we really do believe that those proponents who are removing books from our library shelves are trying to further, really, and you talked about the culture war, they're trying to divide our country by turning our political disagreements into this culture war, and libraries are at the center of it. And we are really looking at making sure that every individual who lives in any community throughout Michigan, so there's 10,000, you know, residents of the state of 10 million residents of the state of Michigan, every individual has a right to challenge a book, but we're just seeing this coordinated and orchestrated attempt to remove books about racism, sexuality, gender, history, and that threat of censorship really creates an environment of fear that leads to restrictions on the access to information, which, as you stated at the very beginning, intellectual freedom is a core value of the library profession, and it's a basic right in our democratic society.
Were you and your colleagues caught off guard a little bit by this backlash that started a couple of years ago? I mean, like you said, I mean, there'd be maybe, what did you say? Maybe one challenge to a book, something like that. Did this kind of catch everybody in your profession by surprise at first when this really all started?
Absolutely. You know, we were all of a sudden, we started to see an increase in books being challenged at our schools, books being challenged at our public libraries. I think before it got to Michigan, the Michigan Library Association recognized that the border between Ohio or Indiana coming into Michigan was not going to matter. You know, politicians listened to other politicians, and we were really nervous about it crossing into our boundaries and that we would have to address legislation. We would have to address the things that were happening locally. And what happened is the election happened, and we have, you know, a new Democratic legislature, Senate, House, and governor, right? And so we haven't gone in the direction of legislation and the ways that other states are dealing with legislation, like Texas and Florida and Indiana and Tennessee. They're faced with this influx of legislation that they're having to address. We're not seeing that here in Michigan. What we are seeing, though, is the attempt to censor information from our public and our school libraries at the local level, which is just as hard to fight. And so we are just drawn into a lot of different areas, and we want to make sure, I think, when we put the website together for My Right to Read, when we put our information of resources and organizations that can help, and here's every single article and radio spot that has talked about any censorship or book banning efforts, those are all on this website. And we wanted to make sure that there was a place that we could address requests. So whether it was a request to show up at a board meeting, whether it was a request to write a letter, whether it was a request just to like, we gotcha, you know, we're here to just to talk back and forth and make sure that you're okay, because there's a lot of fear. Librarians are usually not at the brunt end of the name calling, you know, these kinds of fights, and they are finding themselves kind of fearful of community members who are zealous about getting the books, LGBTQ, BIPOC history books, off of the shelves. And that's a really big issue for us. So I think when we started My Right to Read, we wanted to make sure that there was some place where the general citizenship could go, where our librarians could go, and that there was a place to take action. So I'm not sure we were totally caught off guard. We were ready when a lot of it started to hit. My Right to Read was already up, already processing. And I think that that gave us time to coalesce and to start to grow the coalition. But what we found is that we needed to grow it even bigger. We did a public opinion poll back in March of 2023, just a few months ago, and found that the majority of voters, Democratic, independent, Republican voters in the state of Michigan, do not support book banning, you know, 75%, you know, or higher. And we wanted to make sure that as we started to look at pushing out more information about what was happening in each of our communities, that we were growing the coalition. And the coalition in the last 2 weeks that we have had the public relations campaign on the move, we have grown the coalition by at least 1,500 to 2,000 members.
Oh, that is fantastic. All right. Before we move on, what is the address?
It's myrighttoread.com, myrighttoread.com.
This is a great idea to digitally connect I think everybody who's on, well, I'll just say it, the right side of history here to protect our history and to ensure that all of American history is available for kids and for adults to always read whenever they need it in our library. So it sounds like that this campaign, the My Right to Read campaign, that its goal is to probably get enough people to organize and fight back in greater numbers in their local communities.
We need people to show up. You know, all politics are local. You and yes. I both know that. And it's not rocket science to say that a letter from the Michigan Library Association, while it is a strong letter, the strongest of those will come from the local community. It's the voices of those who are voting members in that community that they're standing up and taking action. And when we talk about taking action, it's post on social, write a letter, you know, to your local media, attend a meeting, give a presentation to Rotary or Chamber of Commerce or, you know, the League of Women Voters. It's leading local groups, right? So we're staying informed of what's happening in your community and making those connections and making sure your friends and neighbors who support the freedom to read, that you get organized. We see a lot of great new organizations, but how to be an ally, make sure people are sending, whether it's a phone call or an email or just a quick thank you note to support our library workers. They are being bombarded on a daily basis with rhetoric that does not belong. And again, while we protect the First Amendment, we want to also fight misinformation. And we're also promoting, if you feel the need, you better run for office, because what we're looking for is we need elected officials that are going to protect and champion intellectual freedom and privacy and access for all. So we are actually got into the, you know, as we looked at our take action, that in and of itself, we have to have people that are going to run for our school boards and our library boards and our city commissions and our county commissions that are not afraid to stand up, throw their hat into the ring and be a part of that conversation to protect our First Amendment rights.
Can't argue with you there, especially on the importance of running for local elections in your own community. That is just as key as national elections, even, you know, statewide elections too. This is just as important. Absolutely. Debbie, I was wondering if I could ask you something, because you just, you also said something, what was it? I should have written it down. I think you said you're just looking for people that support the right to read. It's something I never thought we'd ever really have to talk about in America in 2023. Really, I didn't. It's kind of a sad commentary in a way where we are, at least for that, there's a section of people who are trying to attack that basic right, the right to read.
Yeah, we don't talk a lot about specific book. I mean, there's a book in the library that will offend all of us, right? I'm sure. Right. But somebody else may need that book. And I think that what we're protecting is the First Amendment, that we want to protect Michiganders' right to read. We want to oppose attempts to ban books from Michigan libraries. We want to educate the public about what this all means. You know, I just kind of stated it, but we believe that while a specific book may not be the right fit for one person, it may still be the perfect fit for another. And what we want to protect is no one individual or a group should make any kind of sweeping decisions that take that process of careful consideration away from the experts who are our librarians, or that choice away from readers, me and you. And it's really important that we stand up and we look at the censorship and book banning. While it's not new, it definitely is unprecedented in terms of how much is being spewed at this moment in time during more of political disagreements and this culture war that we feel like we're all in.
You've brought up individual librarians. I've read stories from across the country, including one recently from National Public Radio, detailing how the viciousness of these book banning fights across the country is leading to some librarians deciding to just leave the profession altogether for fear of their health and for fear of their families, for fear of their safety. Are we noticing a similar trend here?
No.
Okay. Good. No. Good.
Yes and no. You know, we see a lot of movement in the library world, and we've seen that since COVID hit, though. So it's kind of a circular game. What I can say is that librarians are some of the most highly qualified individuals. They all have master's degrees. It's required. They receive significant education and ongoing training. It qualifies them to develop collections that meet a very broad and varied interest of students and of the community members. And I really do believe that their work is to develop collection development policies, which are used to choose the books in their library. Some, you know, the small library that, if we talk about Patmos, which is the one that has been defunded, but
in Ottawa County, right?
You know, 90,000 books, but they're a very small library. If you think about all of the other, even the larger libraries, there's a lot of books in a library. Are you ever going to, you know, if you don't like one, put it back and find another? I mean, that's really the gist of some of this, is that we're not going to please everybody, and not every book is going to please you or me or, you know, our neighbors, right? So the librarians are working extremely hard to develop that library collection that reflects the diversity of the particular community, right? As well as the larger world. We can't be so insular that we think that there's nothing else out there that we should learn about, right? So they're very broad in what they look for and how they develop those collections. And they're qualified to do that after going through the kind of educational process that they do. So we want to make sure that variety of books, while it's not going to please everybody, not every book will please everybody, but we create that variety of books and the diversity of books to make sure that any person walking into that library, whether they are like you or not, that they find what interests them.
And you were bringing up the Patmos Library in Jamestown Township.
Yeah.
There was a millage to raise funding for the library, and it lost last year, I think, and now it's back up for a new millage request this year. And you brought up about how maybe I think the library agreed to add content descriptions to 90,000 books. I think that was my reading.
That was the last that we've heard. So we,
okay.
At this point, I'm not sure we have a comment on what they're going to do.
No, that's fine. My question, though, is like, how many working hours have to be devoted to putting in content descriptions in 90,000 books?
Thousands. I'm not quite sure. Like I said, we don't promote rating systems. We don't promote labeling. There is a children's section, a young adult section, and an adult section. And we really do believe that people and parents, so we're really talking about maybe, you know, the children's and the YA section. Parents are responsible for their children at a public library. They are making the choices for what books their children bring home. And we have to recognize that they have a choice. They have choices. And, you know, it's the responsibility of our libraries to really guarantee and facilitate that access. And it includes content, which some individuals in our society may consider to be unconventional or unpopular or unacceptable. And that's what libraries have done since the beginning of time.
Well, like you said, polls are showing a majority of Americans do oppose these groups trying to infringe on our First Amendment rights. So despite everything, Americans, you know, they are refusing to follow these groups and to allow these groups to have the full say of everybody else. So there's some good news there. They are in the minority, and My Right to Read is fighting to keep it that way.
Yeah, we have the statewide results, if anybody is interested. The statewide results from the March 2023 public opinion survey is on the Michigan Library Association website at mylibraries.org under our advocacy section. And the statewide survey, we wanted to make sure that we had voters in Michigan. We've looked at a lot of national polls, and it's like we get the criticism, well, those are national. Was anybody in Michigan even surveyed? So we decided to expend some resources to get a qualified, solid Michigan public opinion, you know, survey created. And we had 800 voters respond. And we're looking at solid majorities of people who love their libraries, positive rating for librarians, for the 83% would support state legislation that would protect the right to read, you know, that librarians are trustworthy in deciding what books are in the library. It's just a very solid numbers. So we want to make sure that kind of information is put in front of our legislators and our city commissioners and our county commissioners and anybody else that will listen and says it validates our position to protect Michiganders' First Amendment rights and the right to read.
Debbie Mikula, Executive Director of the Michigan Libraries Association. Again, if people want to join the My Right to Read campaign, what should they do?
They should go to the website at mirighttoread.com.
Well, I've visited that site many times and have joined in the effort. And I have to tell you, the more voices that join in this effort and collectively fight back against those pushing for book bans, the better chance we have in developing a society which helps create not only just well-rounded individuals, but also a better sense of community and also a better chance that we have in keeping and strengthening our democracy. So, Debbie, I applaud you and everyone at the Michigan Libraries Association for fighting back against those seeking to divide us and, to put it more simply, just fighting for the common good. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Appreciate all the time that you've given to expound upon on all of the things that are right in our society.
It's progressivism with passion. It's the Left of Lansing podcast, where Pat shines a light on Michigan's progressive movement. Contact Pat at leftoflansing@gmail.com.
That was a great discussion there with Debbie Mikula, and I will post links on leftoflansing.com to the My Right to Read site, so that way you can join the coalition to protect free speech and expression in America. I'll also provide links on my Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram feeds as well. Not only do we have this First Amendment right, which in part provides freedom of speech and expression, but the Supreme Court ruled some 40 years ago that limits what can or cannot be removed from school libraries or public libraries based on content. I mean, libraries are providing information to the public, and restricting that information is restricting free speech. But that's what the right wing is doing, or at least trying to do, and that's what my Left of Lansing Last Call is all about here this week. I said in my opener how the whole point of this right wing's war on the First Amendment and free speech is to eliminate and eradicate the voices from marginalized people in this country, because they don't deem marginalized voices, people, as really important in this country. And that's what the Moms for Liberty group and all those other radical right wing groups are all about. Amanda Marcotte in Salon this week wrote about what's really driving these anti-free speech zealots. She describes how self-described mama bears on a Texas school board meeting expressed their anger and disgust over a poster, listen here now, over a poster showing how people of different races are holding hands. Now, I'm going to repeat that. Self-described mama bears on a Texas school board meeting expressed their anger and disgust over a poster depicting people of different races holding hands. Here are two paragraphs from Marcotte's story, and I'm just going to read it. Here you go. According to ABC 13 Eyewitness News in Houston, things started when school trustee Melissa Duggan declared that she had spoken to parents who were upset about displays of personal ideologies in classrooms. When pressed for an example, according to the news report, Duggan referred to a first grade student whose parent claimed they were so upset by a poster showing hands of people of different races that they transferred classrooms. "I wish I was shocked," Duggan said of the poster. "I'm aware these trends have been happening for years." Now the story continues. Some other members of the school board did, in fact, argue that there was nothing objectionable about such a poster. But Duggan was backed up by another trustee, Misty Odenweller, who insisted that the depiction of race mixing was in some way a violation of the law. The two women are part of Mama Bears Rising, a secretive far-right group fueling the book banning mania in Conroe, Texas, and the surrounding area. At least 59 books have been banned due to their efforts. Look, I can't paint a clearer picture than that. And as Marcotte says perfectly, those who claim to be anti-woke are really trying to hide their own bigotry. But their bigotry is as clear as day. Who would get upset over a poster showing hands of people from different races? Seriously, whose day is ruined by such a poster? Groups like Mama Bears Rising, Moms for Liberty, or Parents Defending Education are part of a well-oiled machine bankrolled by big bucks, and their jobs are to disrupt or take over school boards across the country and then to ban books which attacks their Christian nationalist utopia. As Amanda Marcotte concludes in her story, it's about a movement with a committed ideology that has deep connections to Donald Trump's campaign to end democracy. Please listen to Amanda there. I mean, this ideology is so morally corrupt or bankrupt, many Florida schools are now banning Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. Romeo and Juliet! That's where we are today. These people are so gone, but they have some power and money behind them. The right wing is well-financed, but the best news I can give you right now is that we have the numbers on our side. The polls show it, and the people respect the First Amendment and will fight for the First Amendment in this country. These so-called grassroots local groups going against the First Amendment, they are anything but grassroots. But we have to fight back against them using the ballot box and outnumbering them at local meetings and events. We're on to their game, and we know exactly what they're about. I mean, they may try to ban books with a smile, but we're on to their plans to end democracy. Hey, one may smile and be the villain. All right. I know that's Hamlet and not Romeo and Juliet, but I needed to use that line, and hey, you know, it worked.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wander Beats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to our favorite progressive voice in Michigan. It's Pat Johnston.
That's going to do it for this episode. I cannot believe it. We made it to episode 50 here on this podcast. Please, wherever you listen to Left of Lansing, do me a favor, give it a nice review. I greatly would appreciate that. And please remember to follow me on Twitter. I'm sorry, Elon, I can't call it X, all right? It's always Twitter to me. And you can also follow me on Facebook and the Gram. You can always email me as well, leftoflansing@gmail.com. And please join the My Right to Read Coalition. We progressives not only have the numbers here in Michigan, but we are the common sense alternative to the extreme radical white Christianist nationalist movement. We are showing the entire country how to organize and how to fight back. Until next time, remember, take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan.
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston, written by Pat Johnston, researched by Pat Johnston, edited by Pat Johnston, and hosted by, yes, Pat Johnston. Technical assistance by Dr. Heather. And thanks to our good friend Kirsten for the awesome podcast logo. Remember to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.